Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And today we want to continue our discussion of the headlines concerning the western portion of China, Xinjiang. The news we find at the Taylor Report is rather shocking, particularly since it's a part of the world most Canadians know virtually nothing about, but our parliament has chosen to make rather dramatic charges. So we've been most anxious to talk to people who have actually visited the region. And we're very fortunate. We have Professor Murtaza Haider of Ryerson University, Data Studies. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You, I'm sure, have read the same headlines we have, but you have the advantage of most Canadian readers in that you have traveled there. And I'd like to get your reaction to what you're seeing in the headlines, but also to please tell us when you were there and what you saw and what you make of that region of China.
Absolutely. So starting with a clarification that I actually didn't visit the northern part, which is the which we call growing up Xinjiang or Xinjiang, but I was in China for a few weeks in the summer of 2018, and I visited China for a conference that was arranged by the International Telecommunication Union on the use of data in development, especially urban development, something that I research regularly, how you can use data and analytics to make things better for cities, like improving traffic or housing affordability and the like. And while we were there, while I was there, starting with Nanning, we decided to travel through China, and we arranged our own trips. And the reason I felt that there's something that I can share with you is that every place that I visited, I wanted to eat the food that Uyghurs make. Because growing up next to China, I grew up in Pakistan. So there was a very strong connection to China in Pakistan. And because the borders are connected. And but we never got a chance to socialize when I was growing up with the Chinese, and there wasn't much of an interaction. But we have heard about the food, we have heard about the stories in poems and whatnot, but never got a chance. So it so happened that before I went to China, I became a bit of I sort of liked the food, the northern Chinese food that's made by mostly from their Muslim communities. And Toronto has sort of very unique privilege or advantage that there are two types of Chinese food that are very common that you wouldn't find elsewhere. One is the Hakka Chinese food, which is the Chinese food that's made by Chinese, but in an Indian subcontinent style, which is very common in Toronto. You can get it in Scarborough and Mississauga and elsewhere. And the other one is the northern, northwestern Chinese food, which comes from the Muslim populations there. So when I landed in China, I was searching for the authentic northern, northwestern food. And that's how I actually, in almost every city that I visited, even Beijing, Shanghai, Nanning, Xi'an, and others, I went about and found the restaurants. And then while I was there, I saw other things like mosques and whatnot. So even though I didn't visit in 2018, the northwestern part, which was not part of our itinerary, I happened to meet with the people of that region in main Chinese cities. So that's my exposure.
Well, now that's, of course, you mentioned this, the Islamic aspect of this. And I think in reading about people following the news, believe that the Muslim population is only in that one area. And the suggestion is it's a highly segregated and oppressed community. And from the photographs, from what I've, you know, looking around the net, and people from the region, from China, and but also neighboring countries like Pakistan, elsewhere, they have an entirely view of this population that they don't see it as somehow in any extraordinary stress or a problematic condition. Did you ever get a sense of are Muslims?
Well, I can, you know, again, I give you a few examples just to show how my impressions are quite different from what I read in the newspapers. There was at one of the airports in China, we went and had a meal. And when we were walking around and at the airport, and we saw a big on the restaurant owned and operated by the same Northwestern people. And they had a big poster, like a big, maybe 4 feet wide and 3 feet deep poster of Kaaba, the holy place in Saudi Arabia, right on the wall. And they had on the outside of the restaurant at the airport, they had this big plaque with Arabic prayers on it. And so we went in and we got some food from them, and that's at the airport, right? And then, like, I'm just going to give you some examples. In Shanghai, we stayed in the area called the Bund at a hotel. And then, you know, what you do as a tourist, you go out and start walking. And I, you know, stepped out of my hotel, walked for like hardly a few hundred meters. And then I looked around and there's a mosque, and I went into the mosque. So it's not that you would say that these people are confined, and I don't know, extreme Chinese cities, I found them in big and small cities. So this is an example of Shanghai, that I'm staying at the Bund, very, very famous tourist place, walk for half a kilometer, and all of a sudden I'm in front of a mosque, doors are open, I go inside. Then I was, I think the place is called Xi'an, where I was there, and then there was a World Cup going on, Soccer World Cup, and I stayed, and there were like dozens of these restaurants, and there's a beautiful mosque there. There's dozens of these food restaurants on the same street. So for days, I would just go there in the evening, watch the soccer match, and have my meals there, just talk to people. Conversations were very difficult. No one comprehended English. There were some people who had some proficiency in Arabic, but then my own understanding of Arabic is fairly limited. I can read it, I can write it, but to comprehend it in the way it's spoken today, I'm very poor in it. So I couldn't have very detailed conversations. So if you ask me, what were your impressions after talking to the people? And the answer is the conversations were barely, very limited. But what I can tell you is that, you know, people were going about their business, running their stores. There was no one minding us. There was no one minding them. There's this sense of, you know, there's a very big controlled society, and everyone who doesn't toe the line has to be, I don't know, I didn't get that feeling. I'll give you an example of how things I were different from what I was reading. I landed in Shanghai, and then I went to Nanning, which is the place where the conference was. And when I arrived at Nanning, in the same week, The Economist magazine ran a very interesting story of all places about Nanning. So I imagine I just landed in Nanning, and I'm with my second day walking around doing sightseeing. And then I, you know, open my Economist magazine that I took with me, and there's a story about Nanning and saying it's a small struggling place. And I looked around, I looked at their transportation systems, I looked at their freeways, I looked at, there's nothing like this. Not, first of all, it's not small, it looks like 7 million people. And it's, I wrote to the Economist's editor, letter to the editor, which they never published. And I said, folks, I've read what you have written, but I don't think you've visited place. And if you have, you would see this. So I said, you know, just look around yourself. And it doesn't look like a struggling place or development place, especially a small place. And China is a construction site. You have to realize it. Which way you see it's the cranes, the construction cranes. And I remember the first time I saw that kind of a thing was in Berlin after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. You go to Berlin and the entire city was a construction site, right? They were rebuilding the whole place. And I looked around in Nanning and other places in China, and I could see construction was happening at a very fast pace. So I wrote to the editors of The Economist, and I said, folks, here's what I'm looking at. Tell me what I'm missing, because I can tell you what you have missed. You've missed 7 million people and a vibrant city. So I could see that there's a disconnect. Now, I'm not going to lie to you to say that I wasn't surprised at some things that didn't settle well with me. For example, I couldn't use Google. I couldn't use my email. Our university's email is on Gmail. So that it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? And I don't know. Like, but you really can't use Google or Gmail there. Okay. If you can get past these very big inconveniences, right, like humongous inconveniences, then you probably say, well, you know, you can do other things. You can, if you're not using Google, you can use search some other way. And in the end, what I was reading in the newspapers, the Western newspapers, what I saw myself, economists being just one example, I saw the disconnect. The challenge here is that what I see, the conversation about the Uyghurs and then I think there is enough technology out there and there's enough willingness amongst the people in Canada, especially in newspapers, that we should send people out there. I mean, why do we have to listen to this second, third-hand account of what is happening and these grainy satellite videos or grainy satellite images? I started my career before I became a professor. I was a journalist in Pakistan. And the first thing I learned about journalism is that when you hear a story, you visit the site. You don't speak of a person who is hiding somewhere in France and who is a human rights activist who fled someplace and I'm going to get the secondhand account from this person and would not visit the place of which they... So I think this first lack of firsthand account is kind of troubling in this case. I wish I get an opportunity to go and visit and ask these questions as to why people, governments are making their policy about China based on grainy videos and grainy satellite images. Meanwhile, when they wanted to catch someone, they show you images of their license plates from satellites, right? Like, for example, if you have to kill an Iranian commander on a foreign soil, then in Iraq, you can bomb them through drones and you have the perfect images and say, oh, no, we know he was in this car and look, we can read the headlines from his newspaper from our cameras. But when it comes to someplace like Uyghurs or China, oh, we just got these grainy videos. We don't know. It looks like the earth has been moved. It looks like a mass grave and whatnot. So I really honestly, I'm not saying either that it's not happening, that there's no discrimination or there's no such thing. All these allegations are false. But I also know that I can also not say that they are true, but what I'm seeing missing is people just taking a trip, I just looked at it. I think China seems to be a safer place than elsewhere. Today, I was checking statistics. There were about 4,600 deaths in China from COVID-19, much, much, much less than Brazil or US or Canada. So it appears that as far as COVID-19 is concerned, that may be a safer place to be in China. But if there's some brave soul willing to travel, like, I mean, we've got great newspapers in Canada, someone should be able to send their foreign affairs columnists, writers, some television station should send a crew. If it so happens that people try to go there and they've been denied visits or they have not given visas, then that's a different conversation and we should have that in open. But if it's the case that no one actually has tried and trying to rely on these secondhand accounts, then I think we deserve better. We deserve better information. We don't want to glance over or ignore human rights violations, regardless of where they are happening. People's dignity and the ability to live freely, as they say fit, as they see their identity is, it's fundamental to human dignity. And any people being denied of that fundamental right needs global protection. But we have to ascertain that first.
This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're speaking to Professor Murtaza Haider, Data Studies, Ryerson University. And Professor, it seems to me you put your finger on something that, I've had the same instinct. I mean, I hear of a story of this type, and unfortunately with COVID, I can't get on a plane, but that was my feeling. I think I was thinking, I wonder what it's really like, even if I, you know, just to physically be in China and if possible in the region of Xinjiang, but there didn't seem to be any great urgency on the part of either parliamentarians or journalists to begin to dig into the story, you might say.
I think the Canadian Parliament should send a visit, a delegation to China, and ask them to visit this place. You can't make legislation parliament. You can't have. You can't conduct your foreign policy based on assumptions or intel from other governments. I think this notion of running your foreign policy based on intel from other governments got us into bombing Iraq, only to find out that there were no weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I remember those hearings where General Colin Powell came out and said, "Yo, here's this tractor, here's this truck, and there's a weapon of mass destruction hiding in it, and therefore we need to bomb Iraq." Well, that was their intel, sourced from someone who was a renegade hiding in Germany, and then the German intelligence told the American intelligence, "We don't believe this guy. There is no weapons of mass destruction." Americans took it to the Security Council and started bombing Iraq. I mean, we have gone through this process once before to know, or many times before, to know that this secondhand information, intel that comes from these people who are deserters or who are freedom fighters, it doesn't matter who may be on the right side of the history or maybe on the wrong side of the history. When you can't just run your foreign policy based on this, and I think there must be smarter people. Ottawa is full of smart people. That's one thing that I've learned. There are very smart people in Ottawa. It's just that they're not often heard when people want to make policy based on their biases or their inclinations. I think there's a tremendous need for Canadian news media. There's a tremendous need for the Canadian Parliament to send a delegation and get to the bottom of it. And if they're denied access, then that should be the story.
Yeah. But now, of course, you're quite right. I mean, the problem, I assume, from the point of view of those who've now, as you know, sort of painted themselves into a corner with these rather unscientific and unrespectful approach to a crisis and a problem, now they have to find, if they can, someone smart to rationalize what they've done. You know, as a professor, someone respects facts, and a word has come up in relation to the one authority that seems to be cited all the time, a gentleman named Zenz in Germany, is peer review. Is he the only person that anyone would ask about this issue, that Parliament would take the word of one gentleman in Germany, Mr. Zenz, who, as far as we know, doesn't speak Chinese, does not speak Uyghur, and yet is in command, he says, of a great deal of data? I would get nervous immediately if I were hiring him for any work, because I'd say, how in the world could you possibly sort this out? You know? But again, how about the word peer review? Where are the other experts?
This is a remote part of China. And I remember when we were young, our friends would sit on their motorbikes and then ride through Islamabad to Mardan and then to the northern areas of Pakistan, all the way to the Chinese border. And they would go there and do shopping there, because it's probably a day long or a road. And they have improved the road. The Chinese government, working with Pakistani government, built that road to that northern part. It's called the Silk Road, and it's amazing. It's an amazing feat of engineering. I never had the opportunity to travel myself, but I know that there's been limited interaction just because of the remoteness of the place. There are people, like right next to China is Pakistan. And Pakistan always never shies away from taking up the cause of distressed Muslim communities. Pakistan was at the forefront of to help the Bosnian Muslims when they were in trouble. Almost no one in Europe was assisting them. And at that time, Pakistan was very proactive. For me to think that the right next to China is Pakistan, and it's not a big news there. Like if you open up today's Dawn newspaper or today's The News or Express Tribune or Urdu language newspapers, the newspaper with the biggest circulation is Jung. The other one, which is more conservative, is Nawai Waqt. And I read these newspapers on a daily basis. I see no coverage of this issue in Pakistan, which is hardly 800 kilometers from that place. Right. So I think there's something is missing. There's something is missing in a sense that people who are in the region are not alarmed, but somehow 8,000 miles away, countries, NATO countries are quite riled up about it. So there's a need to dig deeper. I, for one, I'm saying that I'm speaking strictly from a perspective of ignorance rather than authority. And the reason I'm speaking from a vantage point of sort of ignorance is because I don't see firsthand accounts. And I think there's an opportunity here for us to send our representatives there to get to the bottom of it. Because if you rely on, and the reference to Germany was to for the same reference for the Iraq war, that primary evidence that was used to bomb Iraq was from someone who fled Iraq, was seeking refuge in Germany, and that person gave evidence to the German intelligence, which was given to the American intelligence with all the caveats, but the American intelligence removed the caveats and then presented it to the rest of the world as the facts. I'm not saying there are exact same parallels. Nope, not at all. All I'm saying is that we should get to the bottom of it to try to get to firsthand accounts to see if there is a violation of human rights, if people's dignities and people's identities are being compromised or are being destroyed, and if violence is being used by a state against its own people, we have to get to the bottom of it. But if it's all propaganda, then we should back off.
Absolutely. There is this other matter of the disrespect of, you've outlined Pakistan. There are other states in the region, also Muslim states, none of whom have been making these accusations. And one would think that the parliamentarian in Canada would say, well, I should probably speak to Chinese officials. I should send, if possible, a group of parliamentarians, but I should also visit countries in the region and ask their opinion.
And look, last time when China was not part of the global community, Kissinger was smuggled to China from Pakistan, right? That's in the 60s. That's how he got to China in the first place.
I'm sorry, what was smuggled?
Pardon?
What was smuggled?
Henry Kissinger, because that first contact with the Chinese government happened through the Pakistani route, not through Beijing or Shanghai. So Pakistan is still there. There are countries that have taken up the cause of Muslims globally. One is China, one is Pakistan, one is Iran, one is Saudi Arabia. You have got three countries there who would have sounded alarm if there was something going on there. Now, mind you, these countries, minus Saudi Arabia, China and Iran has a very strong relationship. Pakistan and China has a very strong relationship, and both in terms of economic and military. So you may say that there may be, because of their vested interests, the state may be silent because the state, Pakistani state or the Iranian state, is receiving a lot of support from Chinese state for military and economic development. That could be the case, but that would not explain Pakistan's free press. That is not saying anything about it. Iran may not have a free press, but again, at least you could see the Iranian government saying something. I haven't seen it. I'm not saying that they're not saying anything. I'm saying I haven't seen anything. Maybe your listeners would know better. But I think if you don't want to ask China, ask others in the neighborhood. For informed policymaking, foreign policymaking, you really need to understand what's happening in the region, not just in the country of interest, but also what the neighbors are thinking. You have India there. India is a very large player in that equation. So is Pakistan. So is Iran. At least start with the neighbors. Tell us what the conversations were. We would love to hear what our governments think, what our businesses think. People are still doing business with China. I mean, you can put all sorts of restrictions, but do you think that they would stop getting things manufactured in China? That's not the case. I think, for example, the next step after, look, if the government is really concerned, what kind of advisory the government is providing to all those companies and businesses who are importing stuff from China. If I go to any store today, Walmart, Costco, Canadian Tire, Lowe's, if I go to any of these stores, large number of goods that you can purchase there are made in China. If you are so concerned about the state of human rights in a place, then you should also provide advisory to the companies and businesses who are making all this business here, saying stop selling these places because they are being manufactured by the people who are being exploited. I don't see that conversation happening, but I see legislation and policies being made that may be benign in the sense, but have a credible propaganda value.
Yes. There's this other issue of involved that once extreme language is used, as the word genocide, it empowers the people who are choosing to speak that way to interfere in the relations of the region and to demonize a particular state. I mean, it has terrific, it has, you might say, neocolonial hazard involved. I don't hear anyone sounding alarms about, you know, this is, if Western countries are going to lead all the discussion, disrespecting the views of the people of the region, it could lead to unpleasant consequences, not just with China, but other states in the area.
So, yeah, I mean, we have a selective way of looking at things. I mean, you know, for me, I have a slightly different perspective. I see, for example, when President Obama was given the Nobel Peace Prize, then soon afterwards, he was busy bombing Pakistan and Afghanistan through drone strikes, you know, unmanned planes dropping bombs in the northern areas of Pakistan and in Afghanistan and other places, and not one or two, hundreds of times, much more so than President George W. Bush did. So there's a difference in opinion, the way West sees human rights and celebrates human rights and give the Nobel Peace Prizes to people who end up bombing sovereign states. And there's another way the rest of the world looks at what is peace, what is human rights and whatnot. I think the use of the word genocide is very important, especially if someone uses this phrase and is genuinely concerned about the plight of a people subject to genocide, that they should act than just weakly worded statements. Then the onus on the civilized world is to act immediately and explore what is going on, investigate and act strongly, because we cannot have this notion of this is happening on the other side of the Atlantic. It's not our concern. It is becomes everybody's concern when people are being discriminated because of their religion, race, color, or any other identity that they think is important to them. And that's why I think that my request is not to believe me, or not to believe anybody else, but for us to make a genuine effort to learn more about what is going on so that we are informed rather than being told.
Yes. But I really like your point. I think it's very helpful. I'm so glad that I'm talking to somebody who's been in China, spoken to Muslims in China. Maybe I should ask you on the last point, in terms of your own visit, did you find the people you spoke to be fearful? Were they comfortable with you and you were comfortable with them? Because that's usually a sign to a visitor, the kind of state he's in.
No, not at all. I sat down and they were having a laugh at me because I could speak some words which were common in Arabic, and I can order a food item. And so it was more about laughs at and in a very relaxed environment. I met with the calligraphers who were continue to specialize in Islamic calligraphy in the Kufi style of writing Arabic, Khat-e Kufi. And I met them there. It's just on the street. I wasn't looking for them. I was a tourist to China. I had no idea these communities were there. It wasn't a planned visit to see them, but once I saw food, I said, I'm not going to miss on that opportunity, right? So that was my incentive. I didn't see fear. Look, China has a great lot to contribute. And if you just go to the engineering labs at the University of Toronto, if you just walk through the science labs where people are doing masters and PhDs, and you will see how many, not one or two, but dozens of Chinese students of Chinese origin working in our computer science, civil engineering, mechanical engineering, industrial engineering, and other scientific labs here at the University of Toronto and Ryerson University and York University. We cannot demonize a people on one hand and then have their very best talent supporting the very research we need in our universities and in our economies on the other. We need to find a balance. We need to have dialogues. We can get down the wrong side of the history very quickly if we abandon dialogue and conversations with people for just, here's an intel from an unnamed source somewhere in Langley or somewhere else. Nope, let's not do that. We have people here, you know, just walk into any engineering lab at the University of Toronto and see how many people you can talk to. and here and there now under no threat. They're in the security and comfort of what Canada has to offer. Ask people here and then ask people there. Let there be a conversation rather than rumors.
That's a very nice summary, Professor Mortensen-Heider. Thank you very, very much for being our guest.
Thank you indeed.